Coming up on Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway, we talk with Brian Drutman about his many years in the cast recording business. Peter gives us his review of Hamilton and the new group's production of Mercury Fur. Michael chimes in with a few reviews of cast recordings, and that plus a little bit of news. Please stay tuned. And welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, August 23rd, 2015. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this morning, we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books. His most recent is The Great Parade, available everywhere. His columns appear at MTI, Critcherland, Masterworks, Broadway, Broadway Select, and many other places. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning.
Peter, there's been a lot of positive feedback about your column from Newtown last week.
Yeah, the show Liberty Smith, which is a terrific musical, and I hope it gets licensed because it'd be a great show for kids, high schoolers, middle schoolers. But I doubt that we'll ever have the feeling that we had in Newtown watching so many kids who survived that terrible massacre on the 14th of December a couple of years ago. The 1214 Foundation has been formed to help kids get through this, and one of the things they do is a musical. And I really do hope tremendously that people will do Liberty Smith, but I also hope that people such as Van Dean and Michael Barodi and Michael Unger and Jeffrey Saver continue doing wonderful work out there in Newtown to get those kids to continue to do musicals, to lift their spirits and the spirits of the parents too. Everybody out there has suffered tremendously, so musicals can certainly help along with time. So let's see more shows with the wonderful quality of Liberty Smith, not only in the quality of the musical but in the quality of production, because these people out there do a fabulous job with these kids.
It's one of the things that I wanted to point out, that had I not heard about it from you on Broadway Radio or read about it in your column, I didn't see much coverage of it. So, we encourage people, if you hear of anything really wonderful or see something really wonderful, to let us know about it so that we can put the appropriate spotlight on it. It's really wonderful what 1214 and Van Dean and the other folks are doing up there. So let's try to bring the good things to the forefront.
Good idea.
Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, The Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a theatrical photographer whose photos have appeared in the New York Times and other major publications. You can see his photography work at followspotphoto.com. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning. And one example of what you just mentioned is, I guess a lot of people do know about it because I've been told that it's practically sold out already. There's going to be a one-night-only benefit performance of Gross Indecency, the three trials of Oscar Wilde, to benefit the Tectonic Theater Company, which it originally – and this is in response to – they were apparently supposed to do it in Russia a few months ago, several months ago, and the production was closed down by the Kremlin because of incredible anti-gay feelings in Russia, which I guess, is a country that seems like it's broken and it's going to be that way for centuries. I guess, I don't know, we could, get into it, but I suppose all of those decades in living under those conditions, It's kind of like having a horrible parent, isn't it? And then the children often wind up becoming very, very, very dysfunctional themselves. At any rate, there's going to be this performance. It sounds like it's going to be amazing. Michael Emerson is going to create his original role of Oscar Wilde, which he did in the original off-Broadway production at the Barrow Street Theater when I think nobody knew who he was. I think it was his first major thing, and now of course he's a TV star and a stage star. And then Jonathan Groff is going to be Bosie, and then an incredible cast of all stars, including Judith Light and Sally Field and Darren Criss. David Hyde Pierce are going to be reading the other roles in various. They're going to be split up in various ways. So I'm told that I think only the most expensive seats are still available. It's at the Gerald Lynch Theater at John Jay, which is relatively small. I think only 700 seats. But if you have the money and you're free that night, it might be something you would really want to catch.
So
night is it, Michael?
It is on October 5th, 2015 at 7 p.m. I'm not sure what day of the week that is, but it's October
Monday
5th. And the $50, $85, and $125 are sold out. You still have $250s, $500, and $1,000 available.
Wow.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So the $250s, you know, for less than a seat to Hamilton.
Yeah.
See this.
So, except they're gone. But yeah, open
yeah.
those cancellations.
Yeah. Yeah. So I will put links to this in the show notes, and maybe we'll get somebody from Tectonic on. See if we can get maybe Moises to come on and chat about this in the next couple of weeks. With us today, we have a very special guest. Brian Drudman is joining us by phone from a vacation spot to the north of New York, and our Broadway fans. I'm going to say that just some of the recent projects that Brian has worked on is the cast recordings of American in Paris, Honeymoon in Vegas, Rocky the Musical, Wicked's 10th Anniversary Edition, Hedwig and the Angry Inch, West Side Story. He did some marketing and publicity for the San Francisco Symphony, which we covered here on Broadway Radio. Brian, thanks for getting up on a Sunday morning and talking with us. We really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure, and I've been up for hours.
Oh. Well, I want to say that we're here talking about just an amazing career of cast recordings that you've had. You were vice president of Broadway and soundtracks at Universal Music Group and the Decca Label Group and Verve Music. I mean, tell us about how the cast album landscape has changed for you over the years that you've been in the business.
Sure, thank you, and I appreciate the opportunity to chat. I've always loved cast albums. I grew up with them. Obviously, it really spurred my interest in theater and the genre in general. So it was a lot of fun to eventually get into that end of the business. And the thing that's changed most, of course, is the economics about cast albums. Artistically, I think albums have improved tremendously from what I grew up with. I think the economics have gone, unfortunately, the opposite direction. When I grew up, of course, I grew up in the LP era, and cast albums were just so much briefer. They were just they were basically souvenirs of shows, and you know, you guys know much more about this than I do, so you can sort of get into that. But the cast album today is so much more complete and just all inclusive than it was years ago, and that's a wonderful thing. Unfortunately, the economics, as I say, have been so difficult for cast albums. They're very, very expensive to record. They're in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. They generally cost around $400,000 for a host of reasons. The payment scales are just so high on recording these albums, and they sell to collectors and to fans and aficionados, but they don't sell as pop music necessarily the way they once did. So that the return on the investment is much smaller, and therefore it's riskier for large companies to get involved. And large companies only want to be involved if they can show a tremendous profit. So they've grown less interested in pursuing cast recordings. Small, more independent producers have shown the interest in being involved. And even they have created a new model by which the shows themselves are, in many cases, in most cases, paying for the lion's share of the cast recording. And the record companies are basically facilitating the project and distributing it. But we're finding that the shows are more and more in a position to really own the recording, which was not the case, say, 30 years ago or even 15 years ago.
Brian, I remember you telling me once that many people buy the albums actually at the theater, and that, in fact, if Seussical had run a week or so more, that it would have paid off. Am I correct in remembering that?
Yes, it's so true. And I remember that the same was the case in The Boy from Oz with Hugh Jackman, where we were selling a tremendous number of albums at the theater. And obviously tickets, and then when Hugh left, basically the show closed after Hugh left, but the all the cast album sales completely dried up. It was as if without that event happening, the interest disappeared.
All right. The question becomes, in the old days, buying the album at the theater was substantially more costly than buying it at your local record store. Now that your local record store doesn't exist anymore, people buy them right then and there more because they can't get them anywhere else, or is it because they also want to listen to them on the way home in the car?
It's an interesting question. I think that the record store, the physical place to buy it, is less a factor because you can, if you're going to make the effort to purchase the music outside of the theater at a time or a place that's later than when you just saw the show, it's just as easy to go online and to purchase it as it would be to say to actually go into a physical store. So that kind of example hasn't changed as much. In the theater, it really is. It's on your mind. It's there. And they still are considerably higher. The recordings are considerably higher at the theater than they would be anywhere else. But, you know, I think it's this idea of having the souvenir of being there at the moment, which just encourages people to do that. I don't think the price is the issue. When you're paying $140, $160, I think the average ticket at Hamilton now is $167 or something like that. When you're paying that for a ticket, then $20 for the album really does seem like peanuts. Mm-hmm. And especially in comparison with the drink you just bought for $8 as well. So it's... The price of
$8.
Well,
$12.
Is it $12? Oh,
yes.
I sneak my own in. That's right. I avoid that. But you know, so the price of the recording is actually not in comparison is not that bad.
Well, I've always said, and I've probably said this to you at least once, Brian, that I always thought it was so short-sighted of companies to not finance cast albums, because even though they don't make a lot of money initially, they, you know, many of them do over time as people, you know, keep doing the shows in community theater and high schools and colleges and et cetera, et cetera. And so, you know, if it wasn't so important for them to make all of that money right away, I think ultimately it's a better business decision. Now, on the other hand, in recent years, we have seen so many of these companies change hands so many times. So maybe in that sense, I mean, somebody's still making the money, but not necessarily the initial people. Did you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's an interesting idea because at the time, for a long time, producers just didn't have it in their theater. Producers didn't have it in their mindset. The idea of financing a show, of financing an album, which does seem very strange because, you know, even when I got started in the business, a producer was able, or let's say a consortium of producers, because it really is so expensive, producers could fathom the idea of putting $12 million into a show, but couldn't see around spending an extra $400,000 to do a cast album, which they would own, you know, the same way they would own the scenery or the costumes or what have you. So that was a bit of an odd duck that they always said, well, you know, this cast album is something we don't really want to get involved in. Why should we get involved in? The record companies do. And the record companies, by the same token, were truly interested in operating, in going into a business where they made money. And this is from the beginning. This is from the very, this is the reason, of course, Decca even went into that business in 1943 with Oklahoma, was the idea that here was another avenue to make a few bucks. And you know, for as we know, for a very, very long time, the record companies made a great deal of money on cast albums. And exactly as you said, once you owned the cast album, it was yours to use in perpetuity. So when TV advertising started becoming very, very successful and useful, you could loan out songs from recordings for TV commercials and other stuff and movies and et cetera. So there was the second exploitation aspect of it was a tremendous moneymaker for the recordings. And then the record companies just stopped making a lot of money on the recordings, and they started they saw that the recordings were costing more than their returns, so they just eased out of it. Part of the problem is even worse than that on the part of the record company, which is that it wasn't enough to just make money. You had to make a lot of money. When I started in the business, I was doing reissues from the Decca catalog. There were all these recordings that had not been on CD. In a couple of cases, they hadn't been out even, you know, a couple of songs hadn't been out. You'd find stuff that had never been released and all that kind of thing. And the record company was, and my cap on those was maybe 5,000 units. And Decca was thrilled. They said, you know, we're not making a lot of money, but we're making a few bucks, and it's adding prestige to our company. And keep doing it, Brian. You know, you're worth having us do this. And then they told me to stop because it wasn't making enough money. It had to be. It wasn't just making money. It had to be in tremendous sums. So they said, don't do it. And that's unfortunate. That the record companies got to sort of that point in their lives. So as we've seen, nobody was going to record these record shows, and the producers decided that it was better to have them recorded and at least use them as a marketing tool than to not do it. And if it meant getting involved in recording your own show, then so be it.
But fortunately, it seems like almost everyone has now come aboard with that idea of it and that concept. And even they realize that even shows that don't do that well are much more likely to have some kind of a future life if there's a cast album.
Absolutely there is. I mean, and most producers are fine with that and exactly right. I mean, so many shows, even if they don't make their investment back initially, they do make it back at a future point down the road. Sometimes you don't see that. I mean, sometimes a composer is still forced to essentially finance their own cast. I remember the case of Bonnie and Clyde. None of the record. We at Decca were actually supposed to record it and then found out it was going to close. So the executive said, well, if the show is closing, we want no involvement in it. So we've had to back away, unfortunately, but no other company was willing to do it. And finally, Frank Wildhorn, essentially subsidized, his own recording of that show. So you do see a little bit of that if you have a composer who's got the means to do it.
Brian,
that may very well have paid off, though, because Bonnie and Clyde has received an inordinately surprising number of productions in this country. Not only that, I am told that the Dying Ain't So Bad song has become an amazing song for auditions that I've heard some people who audition complain, and I don't mean that in the worst sense of the word. I just mean the fact that they hear it all the time. They don't like the song. It's just somebody else comes in and starts doing it again. So that may very well have paid off. But, of course, the question becomes, I don't know how many heard that on the cast album or how many heard it on YouTube.
Right.
Brian, let me ask you about about the off-Broadway space. Obviously, the a majority of the Broadway shows are on board with taking into account the recording into their Broadway budget. But what happens in the off-Broadway space? Do you see this as a movement in the off-Broadway productions starting to understand that they need to do this as well?
Yeah, I didn't know off-Broadway still existed. I'm kidding. No. It was, you know, I remember the time when off-Broadway recordings were the equivalent of Broadway recordings. There were as many in the Decca catalog as there were Broadway shows, and it was amazing. It was the same philosophy. You could, if there were songs that were going to be hits and it was popular, then you recorded it regardless of sort of where the venue was. Mm-hmm. I think today you just don't see the off-Broadway producers thinking about the recording as much. I think they're concentrating far more on trying to move the show to Broadway.
Right.
And what you'll often see is if a show has sort of a commitment for Broadway, then they try to often do the recording in between the off-Broadway and the Broadway run, where it can sometimes be cheaper because of the contract, lapses in the contract and other things like that. But I think the good news for us who love recordings is that everything gets recorded, essentially somehow by hook or by crook, whether it's even in a garage, that's awfully good news. And unfortunately,
but a lot of people have alleged the fact that everything gets recorded has actually made the average consumer more wary, because he's bought a couple of these things that a lot of collectors I know do not buy everything anymore, because everything means a lot of junk and stuff that doesn't appeal to them in what even seems to them to be a Broadway sounding show. So that's a problem too, that with everything getting recorded, where do you draw the line on what to buy? And a lot of people have given up because of that.
Well, gee, that's interesting. I mean, I never thought of it that way. I guess if one has a completist attitude, which there's nothing necessarily wrong with that, but that's that person's issue, right? I mean, I don't think that things should not be recorded because certain people don't.
Oh, I'm not saying that. What I am saying is, however, the glut on the market of recordings of shows that are not worthwhile has caused a lot of people to be wary about buying the next, taking a chance on a title they don't know. I mean, when I did this recent book, The Great Parade, it was astonishing to me to see that recordings, cast albums such as 110 in the Shade, The Girl Who Came to Supper, were bestsellers once upon a time. That shows like Here's Love actually made the charts. Something like that doesn't happen anymore, because I think in those days people were willing to take a chance that the average Broadway musical had a type of quality about it that it was worth hearing, where there have been so many recordings now of things that aren't very good, that that type of let me take a chance to see what's going on Broadway right now has disappeared.
But on the plus side, I believe that there are now many ways to sample recordings before you actually buy them online. So that is a tool that people did not used to have sort of see if they're going to, you know, if they, oh, I'm responding to this and I'm going to get this.
I mean, that's exactly right. In my opinion, and I think it's sort of a two-edged sword. While you can, a savvy researcher, an online consumer, can find something about anything they want and where to get it. You can buy anything you want, whenever you want it, and research it. The problem in terms of music is you can often get a pirated version. You can get an illegally something made available which is not quite above board. And a lot of consumers don't care about the quality. I mean, usually the quality is pretty good, but a lot of them don't care if a recording is second or third hand. They just want to have it, and they just don't want to pay for it. So,
well, this brings up another point, though, and that is the fact that at rock concerts, often what you hear that night, you can buy as soon as you get out of the concert. There's been talk about doing that on Broadway, and of course, unions and what have you turn out to be a problem there. Do you ever see the day when people will be able to buy what they heard that night? In other words, that some people may want to hear who's ever in Wicked now, as opposed to Christian Chenoweth and Idina Menzel, because that's who they heard that night.
Right. God,
what a gasp.
Well, you know, sure. The only thing that stops that from happening is the cost. And the thing would be, when we get back to the theater, the fascinating thing about the theater industry is it is dominated by so many union rules.
Yeah.
It's controlled by so many union rules, which are compared to other art forms, very, very old. You know, they're almost 19th century in what they encompass.
Mm.
And it makes it very prohibitive. It's horrible for on small projects where even stuff that you want to, especially with orchestrations, if you want to use stuff, because there are just reuse fees all over the place, which are in place to protect musicians, protect performers, but it does make it difficult. So, you could, the idea, what's holding back, say, recording Eden Espinosa in Wicked that night and getting her recording out on the street the next day is the idea of how much would it cost to record her, and then, how much are you going to pay these performers? Do you have to pay all the performers a fee again? Are you using music that hasn't been recorded again? How many people want it? So that's what the business people are just basically comparing. How much is it going to cost, and how much is it going to return?
And on top of all that, then I would think there would be issues. I mean, I was amazed when Peter was the first person to tell me that some rock concerts, some actual performances are available on the same night. I mean, I think that's astonishing, but really interesting. But I would imagine that, people can have bad nights. And so I guess theoretically.
That's a very good point, Michael.
Yeah.
Well,
good point.
No, it happens. And I guess it would mean that theoretically that every person in the show would have to sign off that on every single performance, unless they got them to do it globally. But then what would you do if someone, was...
Yeah, excellent rebuttal. Excellent rebuttal. Good for you.
Huh. That's,
You are seeing a lot of shows being recorded live because it is just easier than having to transport everybody into it, to get a studio together and to transport everybody into the studio and to put that together. And then, of course, the interesting thing about these studio recordings, of course, which is generally how we always make cast recording, is that it's almost as if you're starting from scratch, a whole new set of you can't use the same orchestrations that you used in the theater. A whole new set has to be rewritten to accommodate essentially the length of the songs that you're putting together, and all of that kind of thing. It's not a facsimile of the show. It's sort of a suggestion of the show. For me, there's sort of a historic irony in that Oklahoma is always considered the first real cast recording because it was the first one to use the orchestra that played on Broadway and the conductor and the orchestrations and and the versions of the songs and the actors and all that. And in fact, it isn't, right? Certainly today, everything is being rewritten for the recording, and it's being done in a way that's very similar to what you see on Broadway, but not exactly right. So,
some of the most famous cast recordings in the contemporary era are the Jesus Christ Superstar and Frank Wildhorn's Jekyll and Hyde, which were concepts before the actual productions. So I wonder, is there something to be said for... Yeah, well, I mean, Frank with Jekyll and Hyde, they had four or five different releases of Jekyll and Hyde, concept, pre-concept, Broadway, post-Broadway, revival. Peter Felicia sings Jekyll, things like that.
Why not?
It's very nice of you, James, not to make me Mr. Hyde.
Well, it was the hair dance mostly that you did.
Yes, right.
So, let's change gears here for a few minutes and talk about Liaisons, their reimagining of Sondheim from the Piano, which, Brian, you're involved with. So why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, it's a fascinating project. Tony DeMar, Anthony DeMar, who's a just a world-renowned classical pianist, with a tremendous love of Sondheim, and why not? What he did was he commissioned essentially 36 composer friends and acquaintances that he had to. He decided he wanted to He wanted to treat Sondheim musically, not so much sort of the 50% of Sondheim, not the lyrics. Mm-hmm. And so what he did was he commissioned 35 of his friends to essentially take a Sondheim song and to do a sort of a version of it, not a new arrangement necessarily, but maybe a new reconsideration of it. And most composers today are just so in awe of Sondheim that it was a labor of love. I'm not suggesting they didn't get paid for it, but they were really glad and willing to do it, and so they took this on. And so what Anthony does is he's performing all 36 of the compositions on the recording, and then he's going out on tour and performing them as well. So he's essentially the filter, the conduit through which these people are expressing themselves. And it is interesting, and some of the composers have, of course, in the past talked about Sondheim's influence on them and performed meditations in music on Sondheim, like someone like Jason Robert Brown. This is a regular thing in his performances where he talks about Sondheim's influence and ways that he's been he interprets Sondheim and others. And what's interesting is the composer list, it really runs the gamut from some sort of traditional theater composers like a Jason Robert Brown to film composers like David Shire, Thomas Newman, to opera, Nico Muhly and Jake Heggie. So it's to alternative, Steve Reich. So it's all over the place. But it is a testament to Sondheim as the preliminary figure in our age of composition, not just theater composition, but of composition in general.
Well, it's incredible. 36 songs over 3 CDs, and you're going to have Tony is going to be performing in the fall in Virginia, in New York. Where's the Sheen Center in October?
That is on Bleecker Street. It's a relatively new performing space. It's kind of an interesting space. It was built as a sort of an Italian the neighborhood around Bleecker there, mm-hmm. and was so originally so ethnically Italian at the turn of the century, and it was built as a social hall with a beautiful proscenium theater at the turn of the century. It's interesting; it became a kitchen when the neighborhood was sort of having some difficulties. It became a soup kitchen for many, many years, up really until as recently as 2009, and then they finally turned it into an art center, and it's named after Fulton Sheen. That's the Sheen behind it, but it's not selectively Catholic. I think Anthony DeMar is Catholic, but I know Sondheim is not. it's a great venue. It's a beautiful space. I've seen some theater there, as a matter of fact. So that's sort of the third one in the trio.
So in New York at Birdland on the 24th of September, the Sheen Center down in Bleecker on October 22nd, and Symphony Space on November 19th. And so that's really wonderful. We really we'll play some clips of the recording on our broadcast here, so people can get a little sample there and see if they can come down and see it live.
That's great. I mean, thank you. What was the most fun for me in listening to it? The songs have interesting titles, which are not always they may be suggestive of the original source song, but something like Duncan Sheik's song "Joanna in Space." I mean, you can sort of figure that out. But there are others, which are harder to discern. And the most fun for us, the theater recording and just theater general lovers, is trying to figure out what song it is that the composers are basing it on. In some cases, they bring in sort of leitmotifs from various songs, and that's even more fun, seeing, you know, how much Sondheim is within this song. So that becomes kind of a parlor game, I think.
Well, yeah, given that Sondheim loves puzzles so much, this is right up his alley.
Right, exactly. That's a very good point. And he has totally, thoroughly endorsed this, endorsed the endeavor, so... what he said, which I always found fascinating about it, was the it wasn't just an arrangement where and Sondheim has felt and has said this that sometimes arrangements they emphasize certain things or erase other things in the song which he hadn't anticipated, which were not really there in his composition. Mm. And what he likes about this is that they are just so. That they're these musings, essentially, on the music, is that they the music is a takeoff point for them to come up with an original composition, and he loves sort of the harmonies that original composers are coming up with based on Sondheim's own original creations.
Well, some of my favorite recordings are that whole Sondheim in jazz series. Which actual label was it? Was it Finsworth, or was it Finsworth Alley, or was it?
It was definitely a Bruce Kimmel label.
Yeah, I know, yeah. It's one of them, but they're fantastic, and you know, just to hear the variations, and in those cases they were, you know, they all pretty much stuck to the original songs quite closely. This sounds like these are more freeform, but it's still, I think it's fantastic.
Well, you know, yeah. The thing is, if we really mourn the death of cast albums, imagine the death of the jazz interpretation albums and mm-hmm. the pop interpretation yeah. albums that used to routinely be out there of shows like Wildcat and even Saratoga. So, yeah.
And some of the huge, huge sellers of West Side Story. Etc.
No, I know. I mean, that's a whole, you know, we could have a whole nother discussion on that, but you're so right. I'm just, even a couple years ago, the young pop teen idol singer Ariana Grande did a version of Popular from Wicked, which was, you know, it only had the slightest connection to the original recording, but it was the same lyrics, obviously, but it was just so cool to hear a theater song done in a pop way, and of course that was de rigueur years ago, and it's not, and I'm not sure why. I mean, it's the style that younger listeners are embracing. It's not the melodies haven't changed. You know, melodies are still as basic as they always were. It's the rhythm, it's the style. So I do not know why you cannot take a theater song and convert it, and why they're not doing more of that.
Let me ask you about the logistics of putting together liaisons with 35 working, popular, very busy composers. How long did this take to put together?
It took over 4 years.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a long, drawn-out process. I think Anthony's been working on it since he was two. And yeah, it's been a very, very long process, and obviously all the works didn't come in at the same time.
Sure.
They people were busy and were doing it as they could, but he was persistent. And he did a few of them as a concert several years ago. It wasn't complete as this. So it's been gestating for a while, and it was recorded just a year ago when he had all 35 together. I think Sondheim was a very young man when it started. But in any case, yeah, it's been a long, almost as long as it takes to put a Broadway show on. You know,
now what happens with this when, you know, you send out a request to Steve Reich and say, you know, I want you to reinterpret this, and it comes back and it's just not to your style.
Yeah.
You know, how do you take 35 different pieces and put them in a 3-album set and make it, you know, flow well. I mean, that's the brilliance of producing.
Sure.
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that, and I don't know if you know, one of the composers came back with something that Tony DeMar said, you know, it just ain't that good. so we're not going to go with it. I don't know if he approached 40 composers and he only got 36 that he liked. I will say this. I'll go on the limb a little bit and say that some of the pieces are quite thorny. you know, I will say I like some much more than others. So I think the and if I were, you know, some are not quite to my taste as maybe to as others are. So I don't know if Anthony loves each one equally, or for that matter, whether Sondheim feels that each, you know, some are more successful than others.
But in a way, that's not the point, right? It's just to offer these very varying styles of interpretations.
Do you know if Sondheim heard one and said, out of the question?
I don't know that. No, no. Okay. I should ask. Maybe for our next year, I'll come up with that. The thing that I'm kind of I'm impressed with is that Anthony can interpret all these songs, because some are, you know, say David Shire writes in a far more traditional, accessible composing manner than Steve Reich does. So the fact that Anthony can perform them all is amazing to me.
Brian, if you'd like, we'll hold on if you get Sondheim on the phone and we could ask. So, well,
I think he's away this weekend too. I don't know.
Well, Brian, thank you so much for getting up on a Sunday. I know that you said you've been up for hours, but taking some time away from your Vermont vacation and chatting with us. It's been wonderful to have you on.
Thank you. It's been such a pleasure. It's been so much fun. And I really can't think of any better way to spend a Sunday morning. So thanks so much.
That's incredibly kind. Thank you, bud.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
Last week, Carrie, Michael, and I reported on Hamilton, but Peter had not seen it until this week. So, Peter, why don't you give us your shake on Hamilton?
It reminded me of a grammar school show in many respects. Now, don't hang up yet. Do not disconnect. No, you know, I'll tell you why. You know, school directors do casting just to get everybody involved. I mentioned seeing Dame Yankees a couple of weeks ago in Massachusetts, where all the girls were playing ball players. And I also mentioned the Dame Yankees where a white guy played Joe Boyd, but when he turned into Joe Hardy, he was black. And there's been this casting in grammar schools, high schools for years, because give everybody a chance. So you'll see Sound of Music with two white kids, two Asian kids, two African-American kids, one Martian, anything to get everybody involved. So Broadway is a big schoolyard when you think of it. I mean, there are all these people standing in the schoolyard waiting for parts, and I think it's really terrific that everybody gets a chance to perform in this show, no matter what race, color, creed you are. And I was also thinking that in past years, there would have been a prologue to set up the fact that, hey, we're all actors putting on a play, and that's what we're doing. And we don't have that. We don't need that. Mm. But that's essentially what's going on, because there isn't a realism about it. And you hear me complain all the time about unit sets and how terrible they are. In a sense, a unit set helps a show like this, because it's not realistic in that way. If there were real sets, it might look a little odd, the fact that the guy who's playing Alexander Hamilton, who also happened to write the book, the music and lyrics, has there ever been such a triumph since George M. Cohan? I mean, really, even Anthony Newley needed help from Leslie Bricusse when he was doing Stop the World, I Want to Get Off, and War of the Grease Paint. So this is really terrific that Lin-Manuel Miranda has been able to do four jobs and do them all very well, but nobody would confuse him with Alexander Hamilton. So it's really a free-for-all, and I think part of the reason it works is the unit set, that it it's not realistic.
Good point.
Yeah, I think it's a wonderful time. One thing I hope that happens is that in the future that I will have a trivia question that will say, what do the Most Happy Fella, the Miles Kruger Showboat, Phantom of the Opera, Rent, and Hamilton have in common? And the answer will be they all had highlight albums. I hope this gets a highlight album as well as a full album, because I would like to hear these songs independent of the rap. And the rap at hip-hop or whatever term it is that I know that I don't know this field well. I don't know it at all. And as a result, I'm sure I'm using the terms incorrectly. And there will be some finicky parliamentarian out there who's going to sell me, no, 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 it's not rap in that section. It's hip-hop. I understand. But the point is, whatever is used in the way that Dreamgirls used rhythm and blues to get its message across without dialogue, I think it would be nice to have an album where we just have the beautiful songs or the show-stopping songs, because they're all terrific. This really is a tremendous triumph in many, many, many ways. It's a very good show, no question. You don't need me to tell you that after all you've heard. I wish that we would have a way of hearing these songs independently of the actual material that just tells us what's going on in between. I did notice, too, did you, that when there was talk of the Federalist Papers, suddenly that we were talking and there was no music. It wasn't set to music, per se, because this is important information that he wanted us to hear, which brings up another point. This is a show that makes you come to it. You have to listen very hard because of these rhymed couplets, which in a way, you know, strangely enough, isn't even that anachronistic, because Hamilton lived not long after Molière was alive, and certainly Molière liked his rhymed couplets. So under those circumstances, you have to listen carefully, and I bet you don't get everything, but of course, In many Broadway musicals, you don't get everything either. You know, it's not until you hear the cast album later, you say, oh, that's what they said. I see. Okay.
Absolutely.
Yeah, you know, so, but this one challenges you more than others. And everybody in is fine. I begrudge it none of its success. And I do think what should happen, though. Here's what should happen. Given there's all this talk about Hamilton coming off the $10 bill, and I bet this show helps that not to happen, by the way.
I know.
I really believe that. But if indeed Hamilton is taken off the $10 bill, I think what should happen is that 50 years from now, at the Richard Rogers Theater, you should get in free if you can come up with one of these rare $10 Hamilton bills that haven't been produced for 50 years anymore. I think that would be a very good idea, a very nice promotion 50 years from now. So save your $10 Hamilton bills so that in 2065, you can get in and see Hamilton free.
I was going to say, maybe we should start stockpiling them.
Right.
Then when I saw the show, I went out afterwards with a friend, and I had a couple of bills in my wallet, and I didn't want to change my 10. I wanted to hold on to it.
<That's funny. laughs>
At least for that night, it felt wrong to get rid of it. You know.
So
man of conscience, Mike.
There is an economic principle that prices double every 11 years. So in 50 years, you're talking about a fivefold increase on Broadway prices. Okay. So we're talking 400, 800, 1600, $3,200 for a Broadway ticket. And if it costs him $10 to get in, I say yes, stockpile those $10 bills.
Wow.
I mean, does the 11-year doubling rule?
I hope.
I think it's probably worse on Broadway.
I'm
wondering. That's what you're saying.
Yeah. Well, the producers went to 100, and that was 2001. So, and look how quickly it's gotten up to what it's gotten up to. And of course, producers started the premium seating,
I paid $100 for Saigon when Saigon first opened.
Oh yeah. That's true, but that was
it was short lived.
Those are special seats. Not every seat was $100.
Yeah.
So they felt that you could see the helicopter better from certain seats. Would you?
I don't recall.
It
was a very long time ago.
It was.
Very, very long.
Virtually a quarter of a century. It's hard to believe that, but it's true.
I think, did somebody say, if you get this wrong, the time between now and Saigon is actually more than the time between Saigon and Vietnam?
Yeah, sure. Sure, it probably is. It's not far from it anyway. Back to the Future.
The
movie Back to the Future. Really? It was talked about going back 30 years. Well, here it is. It's 30 years since Back to the Future.
And has nobody tried to make Back to the Future into a musical?
I not that I've heard of. It's a wonderful movie. I wouldn't mind seeing that happen. I wonder if they do all three versions and condense them. I'm not saying that's a good idea. I just wonder if somebody's thought of that.
it's the new Wolf Hall.
In fact, I remember taking my little boy to see Cats and Big River and Back to the Future, and it was so sad to see the movies wipe the floor with Broadway. I mean, that he came out talking about Back to the Future more than any of either of the other two things I took him to that year. So I feel very bad that Hollywood trumped Broadway, but it did.
All right, so let's move forward. Peter, you also got a chance to see Mercury Fur down at the Signature, so why don't you tell us about that?
Well, you know, Ben Brantley wrote a review of this back when he was in London, and another one for this production, Scott Elliott's production for the New Group. And he talked about being horrified, putting his hand over his mouth because he was so upset at what was going on. If I put my hand over my mouth, it's because I was yawning. I guess Ben's a nicer person than I am, because I wasn't as horrified by what was going on. It seemed terribly familiar to me. Look, I'm not saying that anybody should have a party and do what happens in this show. I am not saying that at all. What I am saying is that the violence that happened in it to me seemed inevitable and terribly familiar. Talking to my girlfriend, who's a big Law and Order fan, she said, well, I can think of two episodes of Law and Order that are very similar to that. So I don't know how squeamish I am or should be, but it didn't pack the wallop. I will say this, that the Linney Theater at the Signature has been totally reconfigured, and it's done like a football field, seats on each side, and the action takes place in the middle. And it's a terribly distressed set. It's garbage is everywhere, that type of thing. Furniture's been upended. And we are told that they're going to have a party there. And the party is one that is not unlike a certain Stanley Kubrick movie in a certain sense. It's not that populous, but nevertheless, it has some of the same values going on. And so you meet one scurrilous character after another. It's very well played. It's astonishingly well played. An actor that isn't familiar to me named Zane Payas does a terrific job. We talk about Hamilton, how it's hard to understand everything because of the rapid hip-hop and everything's going by so fast. This kid speaks a mile a minute, and you really have to pay attention to see what he's saying, to hear what he's saying. But the thing is, he's very youthful in that way. A lot of young people speak very, very quickly, and it's in keeping with that. He has a younger brother whom he bullies terribly. It is interesting who comes in and starts bullying him, pointing out the fact that sometimes we are the aggressors and sometimes we are the victims in various relationships, because somebody will come in who will take nothing from him. He's going to be the person in charge, so on and so forth. So there's a lot of power dynamics going on here before you find out what eventually happens. And I have to say that Vietnam comes into play, and I had a feeling the play was going to go in the direction where we were going to see replicated that famous photograph of the little girl naked running down the street. I really thought that was going to happen, and frankly, I think it's a better scenario than what does happen. I know I'm being a little enigmatic here because I don't want to give everything away, but I will also say that so many people I've talked about have been very disturbed by this play. As I say, I have not. And a lot of people wanted to leave and found this a real problem because of the way that the situation is set up. So they actually give you a little map. I mean that. A map where, in case you really do have to leave, and the way they put it on the map is like, it implies that if you have to go to the bathroom, well, a lot of people are going to the bathroom and then going home, because I have heard many, many people walked out of this or wanted to walk out of this because they found it so unsavory. Mm-hmm. So this is not a show that makes you come out singing, that's entertainment. It's not that at all. But what's more sad, of a show that's supposed to be sensational in both senses of the word, turns out to be boring. I was mostly bored.
Well, I have not seen it, but it certainly sounds like it. It seems to be part of the new mission statement of the new group, which is to just to do shows for shock value's sake, whether in terms of sexual or violent content. That seems to be the way they've decided that they're going to get people into the theater and talking about their shows now. So some people respond to that and some don't. And of course, it depends on the play. I mean, that would even apply to a recent revival that they did, which is the best thing that I've seen them do in many years, which was Sticks and Bones. But
well, another thing, Scott Elliott is very famous for nudity. And and that's another reason why I thought we were going to see a replication of the 9-year-old girl naked running down the street. For those who are fans of nudity, you'll be disappointed.
Isn't that a fairly recent development, though, Peter?
Didn't he direct President Laughter on Broadway and had nudity in that? I mean, nudity in Noel Coward play?
Oh, yes, you're right.
Yeah, so so I think it was a trademark. The women in The Women at Roundabout, at American Theater. I never say the other word, the American Theater. The woman got out of the bathtub. Yes. She didn't have to. Famous actress, too. The one who bullets over Broadway.
Tilly.
Is that her name?
Jennifer Tilly.
Jennifer Tilly. Yeah, Jennifer's, I think is her name. Anyway, nudity was or is a trademark, but you're not going to get any here. And I want people who go there licking their lips thinking they're going to see that, you're going to be very disappointed.
Well, I don't know what to say about that. I've got nothing.
They'll have to wait for the new Thomas Bradshaw play, which is not being done by the new group. It's I think of The Flea, and that sounds like that's going to have plenty of nudity and sexual content.
Well, I should say that this is at the Pershing Square Signature Center and the Romulus Linney Courtyard Theater. It's not a signature production. It's just in the signature space.
Now, Peter, you weren't necessarily indicating that you feel that theater has been permanently reconfigured, have you?
No. Yeah. I can't imagine it has.
Yeah.
All right. Before we wrap up, Michael's going to talk about some cast recordings that we've been neglecting over the last few months. So, Michael, why don't you tell us what you're thinking?
Yes, there of course have been a lot, and I'm a little behind the times here because most of them came out many weeks or even months ago. The new shows for this past Broadway season, three of them, An American in Paris is from Sony, On the Town is from PS Classics, and The King and I is from Decca. So we have three different labels there, so that's good. I thought it would be interesting to mention them, especially when we're talking to Brian Druttman. As it happens, I personally am disappointed in all of these three for various reasons, just the way some of the performances come across and various other aspects of each recording. But still, I'm sure that anyone who enjoyed those shows will be very happy with these. On the Town is two CDs, which probably wasn't absolutely necessary, but you've got that if you want it. And then in addition to those, Masterworks Broadway, I have to say they are continuing to, just when you think they have reissued every possible sort of old Broadway cast album that has ever existed, they come out with some really interesting new things, like the London cast album of Dames at Sea, Betty Davis in Two's Company, a TV musical of Pinocchio that starred Mickey Rooney, and Sir John Gielgud in a show called Ages of Man. Some years ago, I edited a book of cast album reviews to which Peter was one of the contributors, and I'm trying to put it online now. Hopefully, that'll be available soon. But it's amazing how often we would have the listing of the recording and then the label and then with the label in which it originally appeared on LP in some cases, and then whether, you know, and then the CD label. And back in 2004, there were a great many of the older shows that said no CD. But now I find that almost invariably, when I look now at, in 2015, that almost all of those have gotten a CD release at some point. And then, and of course, whether or not they have, then many, many of them are available as downloads. So that is, in terms of availability, as we discussed earlier with Brian, that is one thing that has improved and so much easier for people. I mean, I personally greatly lament the loss of record stores, because one of the most exciting things for me ever to do was to go in and just look around and see what was new and what I didn't know about. And I mean, in case of Broadway cast albums, obviously I would know about them anyway, but you know, vocal recordings, reissues of old things, opera recordings, and now it's, now I just can't do it that way. I do lament that, you know, for people who are in places where there are not, where and were not record stores, you do have Amazon and you do have iTunes and you have all of that. So all of this stuff keeps coming out, and that's great that, whether it's major labels like Decca or the smaller labels, it does seem, as Brian said, that almost everything is getting recorded now, and that's great. Even though, as Peter said, there might be individual cases where we certainly might feel that certain individual shows did not need to be recorded, but somebody's going to like them even if we don't, so they have that option.
Yeah, coming out of Happy 50-ish, they were selling albums for $10, and I'm not that much of a completist that I really needed it. Happy 50-ish I thought was an excruciatingly awful musical, but I will tell you this, the audience that was in that theater adored it. It was the right demographic, and I'm certainly of the right demographic in a certain sense. I won't say I'm 50-ish, but nevertheless, the problems that they're talking about, I've certainly encountered in one way or the other, but I thought they were handled very grossly. With the no taste, not even a minimum of taste. However, this could very well be the I Love You, You're Perfect Now change for the middle-aged set, because that place was rocking with laughter. But yes, that's where I drew the line. I would not buy a cast album of Happy 50-ish. And that's the type of thing I was talking about earlier. You know, those recordings of musicals like Canada and Christie, and when everything started getting recordings, I think that's when it was beginning to be something that was actually injurious to musical theater. I don't begrudge the people who want to have cast albums of their own work getting them. I really don't. But I think a lot of us started thinking twice about buying everything once those recordings started happening, because what was happening is those people were paying for them. That's all it was. If you could pay to have a cast album done, well, then it would get done, you know, and it essentially diluted the worth of cast albums on the market. So
completely understand.
I'll go to bat for On the Town. I thought it was a terrific album, and I will also say that Alicia Humphreys' version of I Can Cook Too is the best I've ever heard. And yes, I have heard the Nancy Walker recording, to say the least. But I like that tremendously much. And as for the Pinocchio, let me point out that what you're getting is Mickey Rooney narrating the tale. So there's a great deal of narration, but the songs are very, very good. Alec Wilder did the music, and terrific, terrific tunes that will stay in your head, surprisingly. But here, too, is another one where I would like a highlights, just hearing the songs themselves. Brian had a point when he said today shows are getting more recorded. There's more on them because the CDs can accommodate more. Yes, but in a way, there have been times when there's been too much on an album that has caused us not to listen as much. They involve more careful listening when there's more on the album, when there's dialogue on the album, that type of thing. So,
well, that goes to what you said before earlier about Hamilton.
Yeah. So I do think that the cast albums, when they basically did the songs, and not even necessarily the way they were done in the theater, you know, like now, I think cast albums replicate. Like if there's an interruption in a song, you know, you will hear that interruption to hear people speak. Well, in the old days, they'd say, let's not do that because it's an album. It's a different experience. And I think the replication of everything that happens in a show on an album may be a mistake.
I have to apologize.
Yeah.
Because I've contributed to the bad cast album recordings.
Okay.
And I just wanted
not asking for any names, Giants.
I'm not giving any names, but good. I'm going to let you know how this happened is that, you know, especially with the advent of less expensive recording tools, you know, various different. I'm not going to say that we recorded in GarageBand on the Macintosh, but we, you know, and that does happen, and you can have great, great outcomes in GarageBand as well. But when cast albums became less expensive to record, I guess back in '97, I was producing the development of a new show, and what we did was we made a recording to submit the recording to the Richard Rogers Award, I think.
Uh-huh.
And we also used it as a, you know, every time we went to investors, investors are like, well, you know, we want to hear a little bit of it. So we invested in making an inexpensive recording, a piano vocal, and it got out of control because, you know, everybody wanted a copy of it. And then people started talking about it. And then we made it for sale online and at Footlight and at Amazon and things like that. And in retrospect, it should have never, ever gotten to the public. and not because you know the people or the material was bad, which just that we didn't put enough, you know, enough money and quality and time into it. It was just a rough cut demo for investors and for the Richard Rogers Award. But it got out there you know, lots of people purchased it and it made a little bit of money. But I can see how that happens. I absolutely can.
Yeah, some of them have so little potential. When I put them in the CD player, before I press the button, I think, this is what they mean when they say you got to face the music.
So, on a very different note, have you guys seen this video on Playbill? It's with Judy Kuhn and Janine Tesori. It was celebrating 20 years of Pocahontas.
Oh, how nice.
They sit down at the piano and they sing Colors of the Wind in all different ways. It's very classic. And I had forgotten about Pocahontas and Colors of the Wind. And I just the Stephen Schwartz lyrics are just incredibly amazing. I love it. And it's caused me to go back and listen to the movie recording. And but I'll put a link for that video in our show notes if listeners want to take a listen to that and see that. It's really nice.
If I recall, that was a situation where Judy is the voice in the actual film, and then there was the separate recording by Vanessa Williams.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, and very similar to...
Well, a lot of those.
Idina Menzel in Frozen. You know, they had somebody record Let It Go, and it turns out the Idina Menzel version became the big thing, even though the other thing was released on pop top 40 radio.
Which was amazing, and maybe like a first and a historic event and a really great thing that happened.
Have you guys heard any rumors, or have your friends seen up at La Jolla Playhouse Bobby and Kristen's new show?
No,
me neither. But it got
some reviews. LA Times reviewed it, and I don't think the Times went out and reviewed it, but I'm interested to see what the next steps are with Up.
Oh, and I missed it, unfortunately. But Betty Buckley, who was on our podcast not that long ago, got rave reviews for her performance in Grey Gardens at the Bay Street Theater.
Yeah.
So that's, I mean, it sounded like that was going to be really, really interesting casting. And apparently she really came through.
All right. So before we wrap up and do our trivia stuff, I want to remind listeners that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us in iTunes. You can listen to us in many other ways. One of the ways is the Stitcher app, which is an application for your iPhone, your BlackBerry, your Android device. Or listen to us on Broadway World Radio. Broadway World plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Peter, for Michael, or for me, as well as links to some of the things we've talked about today, including the video of Judy Kuhn singing with Janine Tesori, will be on the show notes at BroadwayRadio.com. So, Peter, do we have an answer to last week's trivia question?
Yeah, I had asked if anybody knew what the intermediate title was between Tits and Ass, when which was in the playbill, when a chorus line opened at the Newman Theater. They realized that they were giving the joke away. Nobody was laughing when they heard the words tits and ass, so they said, oh, we've got to obfuscate the title. Now, the title that we all know is Dance 10 Looks 3, but there was an intermediate title, and that was my question. What was it? Gregory Blazer from Atlanta knew. Dance 10 Looks 1 was the intermediate title. They decided that the girl was a little less attractive than they decided to make her be. I have a feeling that Pam Blair had something to say about that in doing it. Pam was never a shy performers. So as a result, I think, come on, one. I mean, no, can't you make it three?
Three is mean enough, but one.
I know. I agree. So anyway, and if you don't believe it, you can come to my house and you can hear a bootleg recording of Pam singing Dance 10 Looks 1. It's absolutely true. No. This week's trivia question, I am going to give you three dates that were significant in American history. I'm going to give you two dates that were important in American history and one date that was important in European history. Okay. The American dates are April 1775 and February 1836. The European date is June 1815. What I am looking for are things that happened in that month that turned out to be in a very famous song, a very famous musical. So I'm looking for a song name from a very famous musical, household name musical, that mentions these three historical events that took place in April 1775, June 1815, and February 1836. Start Googling.
All right. So if you have the answer to that, you can email us at trivia@broadwayradio.com and let us know. So on behalf of Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you.